The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our daily news site, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on the use of lasers in the art world. Every once in a while, I'll see headlines about the latest secret painting, long hidden and now discovered under another painting using X-ray analysis. But what if we started using lasers on these paintings? What might that show us, Dave?
Well, it would show us that paintings are actually pretty complicated three-dimensional structures. We think of paintings as being fairly two-dimensional, but there's a lot going on under the surface, as it were. There are a lot of layers of paint. There are brush strokes, which really come to life if you really look at them very closely and three-dimensionally. There's a very complex structure to most of the paintings that we look at.
And so how did this come about? How did someone decide that it's time to use the laser technique?
Well, art historians, first of all, are interested in how paintings were made. What were the kind of brush strokes? What were the types of pigments used? And even more interestingly, they want to catch forgers. And often that's really hard to do with the naked eye. But for example, if you could see that the master painter was painting a certain way or using certain types of pigments or combinations of pigments, and a forger wasn't, then you might be able to easily distinguish the two.
So this actually originated with a technique for analyzing tissues?
Right. This is a sort of a carryover from biomedical imaging. It's a technique called pump probe microscopy, and this is essentially aiming tiny pulses of laser light at an object. And for humans, they use this to image the melanin in our skin. So when they're looking, for example, for skin cancer, this is a technique they can use to look at the pigments in our skin. And one of the scientists that developed this technique wondered, well, hey, there's pigments in paint too, in paintings. So could we use this approach to study artwork as well?
And so they actually started with a mock painting, and then they actually did apply this technique to a precious work of art. What were they able to discern from looking at that?
Well, they looked at a work, a Renaissance painting, in fact, called The Crucifixion, which was painted by Puccio Capanna in around 1330. And one of the interesting things they saw was that Capanna used very different pigments to create each of the angels in the painting. And some of these pigments were very expensive, actually, sometimes more expensive than gold was at the time. So it was really giving the historians some insight into really what went into this painting. And the other thing that was interesting was it looks like Capanna was able to achieve very similar looking colors using very different kinds of pigments, different kinds of chemicals. So again, giving some unique insight into how this work was made.
So is this something that art museums are going to start using right away?
Well, it's an expensive technique. And right now the paintings actually have to be taken to the lab, which isn't very feasible if you're going to analyze a large number of paintings. But as technology advances and the machines that enable this technique get smaller, then it might be something that you might see in potentially a lot of major art museums.
Next up, we have a story with some conflicting advice for flu sufferers. I wondered about this before. If fever helps the body to fight off disease, what does suppressing the fever do? Is it taming an out-of-control mechanism that is harming us, or does it prolong or strengthen the infection? So, Dave, which is it?
Well, this has been a debate that's been raging for decades. As humans, we've been treating fever actually for thousands of years. It dates back to Hippocrates, who recommended extracts of the willow tree bark. For a long time, we've been looking for drugs that make us feel better when we have a cold or a flu, and often when we trying to make ourselves feel better, we're trying to reduce fever. But as you mentioned, Sarah, there's been conflicting thoughts about whether that's actually a good thing. Scientists have thought that the fever may actually help kill the flu virus or maybe even prevent it from multiplying. And so that curbing the fever could actually hurt you in the long run. But studies have been kind of conflicting. There was a 1975 paper that showed that people who had a common cold virus shed more virus particles if they reduced their fever. Also studying ferrets that showed that when you shaved ferrets that had the flu to make them colder and thus reduce their fever, they actually developed more virus particles in their noses, suggesting that fever may actually help reduce the amount of virus in our body.
So this is old evidence. This new study takes things in a different direction. The researchers actually decided to model the effect of fever suppression, right?
And they assume for this modeling that suppressing the fever increases infectivity. And they want to see, well, what impact does this have on a population level? And actually, they found it can have a pretty substantial impact. They conclude that our current use of ibuprofen and acetaminophen can actually lead to a 1% increase in flu cases, and that would translate into 700 extra flu-related deaths a year in the U.S. And according to some of their modeling, it could actually lead to as much as 2,000 more deaths in the U.S. every year, depending on how easily the virus is transmitted from person to person.
So they kind of expected an increase in cases, in that they went in saying, okay, well, if cases increase because of the fever suppression, you know, they're just looking for a number. Do other researchers in the field buy these conclusions?
Well, you have to remember that this modeling is based on some of these older studies, first the 1975 study, but also the ferret study, which some will argue, although ferrets are actually a very good model for seeing how flu affects humans, they're still ferrets. And so some experts are saying that this is extrapolating too much from very limited information we have on exactly what impact taking these drugs has on flu suppression.
So is this really about being selfish? Take the drugs if you want to feel better, but you'll probably go out and infect more people with your germs?
Well, I guess to be safe, and if this study actually holds true, probably the best course of action would be take the drugs to make yourself feel better, but stay at home.
Finally, we have a story on just when exactly the sun will kill us all. As we all know, the sun is always trying to kill us in various ways. UV light gives us cancer, the sun is the true force behind global warming, and the sun is getting gradually bigger and hotter, meaning that at some point in the future, it will cook and swallow the Earth and all of its inhabitants. So, Dave, there's new evidence that this might be a bit further in the future?
That's right, Sarah. Take a deep breath. Earth is actually going to be vaporized a few hundred million years later than we thought. Well, it's not actually Earth itself. It's the water on our planet. And as you mentioned, the sun is getting hotter. And the concern in what recent models have shown is that the sun is going to get so hot that it's going to burn off all the water on the planet in as little as 600 to 700 million years. And the reason this happens is, you know, when we think about global warming, we think about all the greenhouse gases we're pumping into the atmosphere, which does warm the world, but it's really nothing compared to something called the water-driven greenhouse effect, which essentially means that as Earth warms and more water gets into the atmosphere, that water actually traps more heat. And it's sort of this vicious cycle where it starts to trap more and more heat, causing more and more evaporation, more and more heat gets trapped, that you basically have Earth heating up dramatically, at least over the course of hundreds of millions of years.
Okay. We've got some models here that look at this and try to determine when exactly this will happen. Let's start with the one with the shortest timeline. What's the closest we're able to meet our steamy destiny?
Well, according to one model, it could be as little as 600 to 700 million years. But there's a problem with this model in that it's only looking at one dimension of this water-driven greenhouse, and that's altitude, what is happening at various heights above the Earth. What it really doesn't take into account is the impact of clouds. Clouds can actually help radiate heat into space, which actually helps cool the planet. Also places like deserts, which can also help radiate heat, and also the fact that humidity varies from place to place on the planet. In a couple of new studies, when researchers took these factors into account, what they found was that Earth is not going to evaporate, or the water on Earth is not going to evaporate as soon as we thought. It could take as long as 1 to 1.5 billion years, not 600 to 700 million years.
Okay, so we now have a range of our existence lasting. So what about using this model now to look at other planets? Will it help us learn anything about exoplanets?
It will, because obviously when scientists are looking for these alien worlds out there, what they're really trying to find is a planet that can support life, something that's not too dissimilar from Earth. And to do that, we have to have a sense of how habitable these planets are. And that has a lot to do with how hot they are, how close they are to the sun, how bright and hot that sun is. And now that we know about these extra factors that play into the livability and the habitability of a planet, we can sort of expand our boundaries for what types of worlds can actually sustain life.
So we'll actually have someplace to go when the Earth vaporizes.
Exactly.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about how Facebook is like a virus. and how it may actually burn itself out sooner than we think. Also a story about creating a quantum Cheshire cat. For Science Insider, we've got a story about dramatic changes to science funding in Russia. Also a story about a system to save whales that may rely on a sort of cap and trade approach. And finally, for Science Live, this week's Science Live is about selling fossils. Is that good or bad for science? And next week's Science Live is about sharing data from scientific studies. Should the public be able to access the raw data from clinical trials and other studies, especially if they participated? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news, our upcoming live chats, and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.